with Brother Ken's lesson this morning. His title is Up in the Mountain with God. Up in the Mountain with God. And we do have some handouts that are being passed out. Brother Ken, the Lord bless you.
Thank you, Brother Bill. It's a joy to be with you again at convention this morning. And for those of you who weren't here yesterday, just want to mention again, Sister Virginia sends her love to all of you. We've enjoyed the fellowship and the sessions very much, and it's good to be with you. Let's see, how many of you were born after 1962? Raise your hands. Okay. How many of you are married? Raise your hands. All right. How many of you are senior citizens? Raise your hands. Okay. Have I left anybody out? Well, our discussion might seem a little technical in the beginning, but we hope in the latter part to get into some practical applications, and specifically the three groups I mentioned. So do you want to yawn a little and sleep for the first part? I'll wake you up at the practical part. Remember, one of the memorial emblems was the cup. Jesus blessed the cup and he gave it to his disciples and he told them to drink ye all of it, for this is the blood, my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. And actually the Greek is being shed, present tense. It wasn't referring to his death on the cross, but his whole sin offering process, pouring out his soul unto death. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is being shed for the remission of sins. Now we know our friends in Babylon and our even some new covenant brethren feel that this is a text that proves the church is under the new covenant. We're going to approach the theme of the memorial, actually, the benefits of Jesus' death to us personally, and justification, and then suffering and death with him, from a different typical perspective and a symbolic perspective. And it's the perspective of the work that preceded the type preceding the inauguration of the law covenant. And Paul brings this type to our attention, 2 Corinthians, the third chapter, and makes it a type and gives us a lesson, the antitype in it. So we're not left to our own wisdom, our own thinking of what is the antitype of this picture in the Old Testament. Actually, in the Old Testament, in Leviticus account, or rather the Exodus account, between Exodus 19 and Exodus 34, there are four pictures or types of the giving of the law. Now, each one of these pictures has to be kept separate and distinct. You can't mix them, because they don't teach lessons that are chronological in type or antitype. Each one is a beautiful picture of the giving of the law in connection with the law covenant. It's just like a Kodachrome slide. You have four Kodachrome slides. You look at each one in the light, and it's a beautiful picture. But what happens when you put two of those slides together? It's blurred. It's fuzzy. So remember, these are four distinct pictures. The giving of the law in Exodus 19 and 20, chapters Exodus 19 and 20, picture the justice of God shown in the time of trouble, which will bring the people to their need of the mediator. Remember back in Exodus 19 and 20, the Lord appeared to the Israel on the morning of the third day, and the mountain quaked, there were thunders, lightning, shaking, and the voice of God was booming out the law. Commandment 1, Commandment 2, Commandment 3. And the people trembled. And they said, Moses, Moses, tell God to stop speaking to us. We're afraid. You be our mediator. You go between us and God. So that lesson was to teach that in the time of trouble and antitype, and Paul makes an antitypical application of this in Hebrews, the 12th chapter. We're not going to go into it because that's not our lesson. But in the antitype, justice is speaking to the world of mankind now during the time of trouble. And they will finally become so terrified that they will say, we have the need of a mediator. And this will bring their hearts into condition that they will be able to accept the kingdom arrangement. The second picture of the giving of the law in the type was before the tables of the law were written on stone, Moses was given the law and he writes it down on a table of a book in Exodus 24. And here, remember, in connection with the inauguration of the law covenant, bullocks and oxen were oxen and goats were slain, and half of the blood was sprinkled on the tables of not the tables of the law, the book of the law, and half the blood then the rest of the blood was sprinkled on the people. A beautiful lesson we might or might not get into. The third picture of the law, the giving of the law, was the 40 days Moses was up in the mountain. And then remember, when he came down from the mountain, Israel was worshiping the golden calf, and Moses was so enraged that he threw the tables of the law down that God had given him. And that pictured the breaking of the law covenant that was inaugurated in Exodus 24. And then the fourth time Moses, or Israel, received the law was when Moses was up in the mountain the second time, and he received the tables of the law from God again the second time. And Exodus 34, 9 and 10, this account is in Exodus 34, the Lord specifically speaks of making a covenant with them, again, in connection with the giving of the law the second time, the tables of the law the second time. So this fourth picture is the one we're going to zero in on, is the one that Paul zeroes in on. And it is a specific picture of the making of the new covenant with the nation of Israel, because the first covenant was broken, symbolized by Moses breaking the tables of the law because they were worshiping an idol. And it was Israel's idolatry. And remember, an idol isn't just something that's an image. It's anything that comes between you and God. Money, your husband, your wife, your family, your job. And it was always idolatry that caused Israel to break the law covenant. But Exodus 34 becomes a type of a work that has to be done before, in type, the law covenant was renewed, and in antitype, before the new covenant is inaugurated. We gave a handout of the New American Standard Version of 2 Corinthians 3 because there are several things that we feel brings out more clearly the thought of the Greek. But any translation has its weaknesses, and when we come to the weaknesses of this translation, we'll point them out as we go down. Okay, beginning with verse 2. You are our letter, written in our hearts. And the Sinaitic says, written in your hearts. You are our letter written in your hearts, known and read of all men. Being manifest that you are a letter of Christ cared for by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not on tables of stone, but on tables of the human heart. Now notice, he begins to contrast a writing on the tables of stone, or the tablets of stone, which was the writing and letters engraven on stone in the mountain. He begins to contrast that with a writing of the Spirit on the tablets of our hearts. In verse 4, and such confidence we have through Christ toward God. We have this confidence that the writing of this on the tables of our hearts will be accomplished. Not that we are adequate, and here we prefer the King James, not that we are sufficient in ourselves to consider things as coming from ourselves, but our adequacy or our sufficiency is from God. And what does that sufficiency that is from God enable us to do? Verse 6, who also hath made us adequate or able ministers of the new covenant. We feel in verse 5, the sufficiency, we're not sufficient of ourselves, but our sufficiency is of God, refers to our justification. Remember Romans 8, it is God that justifieth, and who is he that condemneth? And what is the purpose of our justification? In this context, it's so that we can be able ministers of the new covenant. But notice what he says about those who are able ministers of the new covenant. Not written, or rather, not of the letter. I'm going to skip the next phrase that I have in solid line and continue the unbroken, or the broken lines that I have underlined. Not of the letter, for the letter kills. Coming back to the phrase, but of the Spirit, for the Spirit gives life. Notice this phrase. Our writing is not of the letter that was on the tables of the law, for that writing killed. But the writing that we're interested in that's happening to us is by the Spirit on the tables of our hearts, and that will give life. Notice how Paul continues this contrast in the next two verses. But if the ministry of death in letters engraven on stones came with glory, so that the sons of Israel could not look intently at the face of Moses because of the glory of his face fading as it was, how shall the ministry of the Spirit fail to be even more glorious? Verse 7. The ministry of death in letters engraven on stones. What did Paul mean that the letters that were engraven on the tables of stones, the giving of the law covenant on tables of stones, was a ministry of death? Well, what happened to that covenant? That law was the basis of the law covenant. And what happened? It resulted in death. The people said, all these things we will do, because God promised if you do these things, you will live. And if you disobey these things, you will die. And they said, oh boy, that's a cinch. Keep 10 commandments and we can live eternally. What more do you want? That's simple. They said, certainly, all these things will we do. The next sentence, they were all condemned, or next second, they were all condemned to death because they had evil in their hearts. That arrangement, as glorious as it was a ministry of death. It resulted in the condemnation of the nation of Israel under the law of covenant. But the ministry of the Spirit, writing the law on the hearts of the ministers of the new covenant, will result in life. Now, if I ask you the question, in verse 6, what is Paul referring to when he says, not of the letter that killeth, but of the Spirit that gives life? I'm sure your response immediately would be, well, keeping the letter of the law results in death, and keeping the Spirit of the law results in life. That's very true. But I don't think that's what Paul's teaching here. We have many other scriptures to prove that, many similar phrases to prove that elsewhere in Scripture. But here Paul is making a contrast between a type and antitype. As Moses was up in the mountain before the law covenant was inaugurated, he had to receive the law, which was the basis of that covenant, the basis of that agreement. Wes was talking about agreements yesterday. And the basis of that agreement was the two tables of the stone that were engraven in letters. And that resulted in death. Why? Because the agreement, the law that Israel had to keep that was going to be administered by Moses, the minister of the law covenant, was written on a separate entity from Moses. It didn't transform Moses. It didn't affect Moses. It didn't qualify Moses character-wise to be able to deal with the people and meet and handle their imperfections. And also the animals and the blood of the animals is in the picture, but that's not the aspect we're dealing with today. But we are the antitype. We are the antitypical Moses. We are ministers of the new covenant. And we're doing a work prior to the inauguration of the new covenant, just as Moses was up in the mountain receiving the law prior to the inauguration of the law covenant. And the ministry of the Spirit is writing the law of that covenant on our hearts. We are becoming imbued with the Spirit of God's law, the Spirit of God's holy principles. They are becoming a part of us. They become our very character. So that when we, as the antitypical Moses, the Christ head and body, mediate the new covenant with the world of mankind, we would just know just what their needs are to help them develop love and perfection, because we have the Spirit of the law in our character. And this will bring life. This ministry of the Spirit will bring life to the world of mankind. And then Paul contrasted glory between these two ministries. Even though Moses' ministry brought death, it was glorious. Well, how was it glorious, Paul? Oh, because the face of Moses shined with the glory of God. He was so close to God on the mountain. And remember that when he came down from the mountain, he had to wear a veil because his face shined so brightly. Let's turn to Exodus 34, verses 6 and 7. And see the glory of the Lord that Moses saw. Moses, or rather God pronounced Moses when he came up to receive the law the second time, that he would show himself to Moses. And the Lord walked before Moses, and he said, verses 6 and 7, and the Lord passed by before him and proclaimed, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sins, and that will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and upon the children's children until the third and the fourth generation. You know, we start reading this and we read verse 6. The Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving the iniquity and transgressions and sin. Oh, and we're so lifted up. And then it all of a sudden seems to unwind, doesn't it? That the guilty by no means, that will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and upon the children's children. Why does this end up in describing God's glorious character with His justice? Oh, what makes God's love? What makes God's mercy? What makes God's kindness? What makes God's long-suffering so meaningful? Because it's based on justice. Remember Brother Russell's observations? Justice first, and then love. Love that is not based upon justice is mere human sentimentality. It is not principled. It has no standards to guide it. Examples. Justice must first be based on love. Say there's a dear old sister lives 50 miles north, and we want to go to a convention that's 200 miles west or south. And we say, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful to pick her up? Go 50 miles out of our way, 50 miles back again, 100 miles out of our way, and then take her to the convention. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Yes, it would. So we do that. And we take her to the convention. And as we're fellowshipping with the brethren, we say, you know, sister so-and-so, this problem, that fault, we start gossiping, evil speaking about her. What does the Lord think of that tremendous sacrifice we made? 100 miles out of our way, each direction from the going to and from the convention. Absolutely meaningless. Because we were unjust to that sister by evil speaking about her. Well, another example. Justice must be based upon love. Brother Russell has I found great sense of direction from it, the reprint article in 1916, Love in the Classes. And he observed that many of the problems in the classes are because brethren do not put justice first and then love. An example that he didn't use, but say, well, a brother's name is up for an elder or a speaker, a visiting speaker, and, well, we love that brother very much. So we vote for him because we love him very much. We don't consider his doctrinal qualifications. We don't consider his character or his qualifications of righteousness. We just love him. He's a lovely brother. And we don't want to hurt his feelings. Because our decisions, or if our decisions, are based upon love that is not founded on justice, truth, and righteousness, it is mere human sentimentality, and consequences will follow. So we are thankful that in this description that God gave us of his glory, of his character, his mercy, his long-suffering, his love, that he gives us the final assurance that this is all based on his justice. And this is what makes his word of love and his acts of love meaningful and enduring. He will never change. So, that arrangement that was unto death was glorious. It revealed the glorious character of God. And the law itself, the Ten Commandments, are glorious. They're beautiful. But that law covenant arrangement did not have a mediator that could offset the imperfections of the people, therefore it resulted in death. Now, remember our basic lesson here. Before Moses could administer the law in the law covenant arrangement, he had to receive the law, which became the basis of the law covenant. Even though it was a glorious arrangement, even though the law was glorious, because he could not offset the imperfections of the people, it was a ministry unto death. But an antitype, we, the antitypical Moses, also have a work to take place before the inauguration of the new covenant. We are now able ministers of the new covenant up in the mountain with the Lord. And two things had to take place before the inauguration of the new covenant. One, the providing of the blood, which is a separate picture, Exodus 24. We're not involved in that at this time. We might yet. And the second thing that has to be done in connection with the new covenant is the mediator or the ministers of the new covenant have to receive the law and have it written in their hearts so that they will be able to effectively administer that law when the new covenant is inaugurated. Now, from verses 11 through 17, if we just skip them and jump to verse 18, well, seemingly the picture is complete. Because in verse 18, Paul says, "But we all, with unveiled face, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from glory to glory, just as from the Lord the Spirit." So here is a fitting climax, conclusion to Paul's lesson. We, the antitypical Moses, with unveiled face, are before the Lord up in the mountain. And what's happening? We're being changed from glory to glory into his glorious image. And even though Moses' arrangement was glorious, our arrangement is far more glorious, or the arrangement of the Christ is far more glorious, because we are being transformed into God's character so that we will be able to adequately deal with the world of mankind and the kingdom. But verses 11 through 17 used to bother me. The whole picture seemed to unravel in these verses because Paul brought the veil in. And it just seemed to give a different direction to what Paul was talking about. But 2 years ago, as you get older, 2 years ago might have been 5 years ago. Time passes so fast, you know. About 2 years ago, I read this in the New American Standard. And all of a sudden, I began to tingle all over. It didn't unravel anymore. It was beautiful. Let's go on from verse 11. For that which fades away, and in the Greek it's fading. For that which is fading, not that the law arrangement has faded away, but for if that which is fading, the law covenant is still in existence. But as Paul says, observed in Hebrews 8, it has waxed old. It is senile. It can't give any benefits. And so now Paul in this verse says, for if that which is fading away was with glory, much more that which remains is in glory. Having therefore such a hope, we use great boldness in our speech. And we are not as Moses. Oh, we have such a hope. And we are bold. We're not as Moses. Moses in the type failed. The ministry in letters on stone failed. But we are not as Moses. Therefore, we have great hope and expectation. Because we know this ministry of the Spirit that's writing the law in our hearts will enable us to deal with the world of mankind and be effective in bringing them up the highway of holiness to perfection. And we are not as Moses, who used to put a veil over his face that the sons of Israel might not look intently at the end of that which was fading away. But their minds are hardened, unbelieving. For until this very day, at the reading of the old covenant, the same veil remains unlifted, because it is removed only in Christ. But to this day, whenever Moses is read, a veil lies over their hearts. But whenever a man, and this is an exact, notice it's in quotes, or rather it's in all caps, this is an exact quote from Exodus 34:34. Whenever a man, and that man was Moses, whenever a man turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. What is this veil? In verses 7 and 11, that Moses did not have on his face when he was before God, but he put on his face when he came down the mountain. And what is this veil in verses 14 and 15 that is still on the hearts of Israel? Well, first of all, there's a difference of opinion as to when Moses... Hi, Paul, are you out there? Paul and I have our rounds on this one. There you are. Okay. There's a difference of opinion as to when Moses wore the veil. According to the Septuagint version, Moses put on the veil, he came down from the mountain, and his face shone as he spoke to the nation of Israel. And then he put on the veil after he spoke to the nation of Israel, went up to the mountain again to talk to God, and when he talked to God, he took the veil off. But the Hebrew manuscript seems to indicate that Moses, when he was before the Lord, he didn't have the veil on. Then when he came down to the mountain, he put the veil on when he spoke to Israel. Okay, one point we are certain of, whether we take the Hebrew or the Septuagint version. One thing we are certain of, that Moses had no veil on his face when he spoke to the Lord, when he was before the Lord. And we are also certain of the application Paul makes of the veil. The purpose of the veil was so that Israel would not see that Moses, the shining, the brightness of Moses' face was fading. The longer Moses was off the mountain, away from the Lord, that brightness would begin to diminish. It would fade away. Okay? What was the purpose of the veil back in Moses' day to prevent Israel from seeing that his face, the brightness of his face, was fading away. The brightness of Moses' face faded gradually. And it pictured the fact that Moses, as the mediator of the law covenant, was fading away. The glory of the law covenant at Mount Sinai was a temporary arrangement. It was going to come to an end. And Moses' face fading, and Moses preventing the brightness fading, and Moses preventing Israel from seeing this brightness fading by putting on the veil, Paul is making a lesson. And the lesson is, they could not see that this law arrangement was fading away. It would only be temporary. Okay, what was the veil that was on the heart of Israel in Paul's day? The glory of the law covenant in Paul's day to the Jews was its ceremonies and rituals. This was the veil that prevented them from seeing the need of Jesus' sacrifice. If they only kept the ceremonies and rituals of the law, then their salvation was assured, they felt. And this prevented them. It was a veil. It prevented them from seeing that salvation was only in Christ. But then verse 16. Whenever you and I in antitype turn to the Lord, the veil is taken away. We are up in the mountain in the presence of the Lord. In verse 17 and 18, now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. But we, the antitypical Moses, all with unveiled face, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image, glory to glory. Brethren, are you up in the mountain or are you down in the valley? In the earthly things. Are you up in the mountain with the Lord? Seeing the glory of His character. Studying His Word that is revealing the glorious image of His dear Son. And is the Spirit of His Word writing on your hearts the glorious law of God that you will administer in the kingdom to the world of mankind. Let's go back to verse 2 and 3. Having therefore such a hope, we use great boldness, for we are not as Moses. The Christ will not fail in the administration of the new covenant and the kingdom. It will bring life to the world of mankind. I'm going to ask you a couple questions. How many of you desire to make your calling and election sure? Raise your hands. Not bad. How many of you expect to make your calling and election sure? Not bad. How many of you know you're going to make your calling election sure? Not bad. One hand. What is hope? A wish? A desire? No. A desire is a wish. Hope is more than a wish and desire. Hope is an expectation. I'll tell you a little story. This teacher had a third grade class, and she said, how many of you wish you'll be millionaires when you grow up? Everybody's hand went up. She said, all right, how many of you expect to be millionaires when you grow up? One hand went up. She says, Johnny, stand up and tell the class why you expect to be a millionaire when you grow up. He says, my uncle's a millionaire, and I'm the only heir. He had expectation. We are heirs of God and joint heirs of Christ. We will become millionaires in a spiritual sense. We will become the rulers in the kingdom. It's not a wish. It's not a desire. It has to be an expectation. Live your hope daily. Every pitiful sight of humanity you see, immediately think of the kingdom and what you'll be able to do for them. When you look at the news on TV and you see those sick things that sick people do to their fellow man, think of the kingdom and rejoice that you will be able to heal those sick minds that are so sick with sin and twisted and gnarled with sin. Live your hope daily, and it will become a live expectation that will motivate you day by day to be faithful unto death. All right, we want to get to some practical aspects of this lesson. One, there's certain things we want to are important to remember while we're in the mountain. One is, we are not alone. Oh yes, the Lord is with us. But our brethren are with us. Let us ever remember that. Let us ever appreciate that. To change the metaphor, in Revelation 21, we have the river that's flowing, and the tree of life that bears 12 manner of fruit, 12 months a year. 12 times 12 is how much? 144 times 1,000 years. 144,000. What is that tree of life? That tree of life is you. That tree of life is me. The Christ. And it will bear 144,000 different manners of fruit. Each member of the little flock is a representation of a type of humanity. A different type of humanity. We're not up in the mountain alone. We're with our brethren. And we're not competing with each other. I can't take their crown. They can't take my crown. Because we each represent a different type of humanity. You know, many of you have tragedies. And you know, there's no Bible student that understands your tragedy. Sometimes we feel that way. Some have lost loved ones in tragic death. Some have marital problems that can't be solved. Some have fatal illness or else a serious illness that will handicap them the rest of their life. A few have experienced child abuse and wake up screaming at night in a nightmare. Some have had a very harsh father, a demanding father image that makes them terrified of their heavenly father. And we could go down the list. And you know, in some of these situations, none of the brethren understand. There's no Bible student that understands. We're all alone. No, we're not all alone. Oh, you say, yes, the Lord is with me. Well, more than that. There are thousands and thousands out there in the world that are having the same experience you're going through. And you know, that's just what it's all about. That's why you're going through this experience. So you can help those thousands out there in the kingdom. Cherish your unique relationship with the Lord, where He was helping you to understand the reason for your tragedy. And let us remember and cherish our brethren, realizing that they will be able to help a segment of mankind that we will not be able to reach because of their unique experiences in this life. How many of you were born? We went through that, didn't we? How many of you were born after 1962? Don't raise your hands. You know, this generation is called the Generation X. The post-boomers, the baby busters, 20-somethings, the slackers, the wimpers. And perhaps Generation X is the most appropriate name because it signifies an unknown veritable, a generation that is in search of meaning. The statistics on this generation predicts that because of their dysfunctional family background, Xers will be imprisoned and executed at a higher rate than any previous generation in U.S. history. According to statistics, every day, 13 members of Generation X commit suicide. 16 are murdered. 1,000 become single mothers each day. Each day, 100,000 bring guns to school. Each day, 2,000 to 200 drop out of school. 500 each day begin using drugs. 1,000 begin drinking alcohol. 3,000 to 500 are assaulted each day. 630 are robbed and 80 are raped each day of this generation. They have been spoken of as the most ignored, the most misunderstood, the most disheartened generation our country has ever seen. They are called the clinically depressed generation. Now, I'm not saying that our younger brethren have done all these things, but our younger brethren have grown up among the Xers. They understand them more than you and I can possibly understand them. They feel their depression. They can understand their motivation. They will be able to help this generation in the kingdom to a degree and extent that you and I will not be able to reach Generation X in the kingdom. And another observation. Because of their generation background, some of our younger brethren are crying out to us, "Don't you understand our emotional needs?" And we cry back to them, "Don't you understand your greatest need is present truth doctrine?" And you know, there's truth in both cries. And I hope the Bible Student Movement will be able to find a way that they can scripturally satisfy both needs of our younger brethren. Their peculiar needs because of the generation they're in, and also their doctrinal needs, the present truth. And remember, our younger brethren will be able to help Generation X in the kingdom to a degree and extent that we will not be able to. We are not alone in the mountain. And then there's the problem of matrimonial problems. In Volume 6, remember, Brother Russell observed that in his day, many of the Lord's people were in the matrimonial furnace of affliction. Back in his day. And those of us who are involved with counseling know that in the Bible Student Movement today, many married couples have serious problems. Why? Oh, there's many reasons. I'll just deal with one. Have you ever contrasted marriage that took place a century ago or two centuries ago? No, 200 years ago, you didn't marry somebody you fell in love with. You marry the person that your parents contracted you or arranged for you to marry. And you went into marriage very realistically. You knew that that marriage would only be happy if you really worked at learning to love your partner. Because you didn't love them at the time you married them. But if you learned to love them in that marriage became very happy. In modern times, we fall head over heels with somebody in love, and we marry them. And we expect matrimonial bliss. But often, there's no bliss. Why? Again, I'll just deal with one reason. Have you ever heard a bridegroom say, "Why, she's everything I ever dreamed of"? Have you ever heard the phrase, "Love is blind"? And you hear, "Why, is he blind?" Oftentimes, a person falls in love what they dream that person to be, what they want that person to be. But that person isn't that image that you're dreaming of. And after the honeymoon, after a year or so, they begin to realize they're married to a stranger. This wasn't what they thought their mate was. And they rebel. And there's friction, there's tension, there's no cooperation. And you find yourself in a shocking situation. What can you do? You're trapped, you're locked in the rest of your life. You know, 40 years ago, I knew such a couple. They both were so embittered after they came to the realization that their mate wasn't the person they thought they were. That they continually argued. They even came to blows. You say, "Well, that poor sister." Well, I don't know. That sister had a terrific right hook. Finally, they came to their senses. They daily prayed together, asking the Lord to help them, asking the Lord to help them in this impossible situation. They made every effort to find qualities in each other that they could admire and appreciate and love. They made every effort to see the hand of the Lord in the life of their mate so they could love their mate as a new creature. And by the Lord's grace, they became one of the closest and most devoted married couples I had ever met to their dying day. Now, not all marital problems will be solved. But remember your hope of the kingdom. Remember, there are thousands and thousands out there that are also having matrimonial problems. And the Lord is writing the law, His law, in your hearts against the background of your trial. And your experiences will become very meaningful. And your joy will be full in the kingdom when you will be able to help a unique category of mankind who are having the same problem that you have. And then there's the golden years. You know, anybody who has passed the age of 65 sometimes can't help but wonder, what's so golden about these years? You know, certainly we don't grow old graciously. Seniors have hearing aids, canes, walkers. Some have arthritis. Seniors have memory problems. And they have sleep problems. And sometimes they wake up in the middle of the night and lay awake for hours. And their whole life just passes before their minds. And they remember all the terrible things they did in their lifetime. And they have such a guilt complex. And they forget that they went to the Lord before, earlier in their life, and that happened, and the Lord forgave them. And the adversary just enters in and tries to work on their guilt complex. Don't let them work on it. Remember that the past is under the blood. And then there's the problem of memory. I remember dear old Brother Comer of New Brunswick. He lived to be 104. In his 80s, he said he spent 75% of his time looking for things that he couldn't remember where he placed them. How many of you have walked into the kitchen, into the bedroom, the basement, the study, and all of a sudden you're dumbfounded? What am I here for? It happens. And then, you know, you start writing notes to remind you what to do the next day. You might even wake up in the middle of the night and get up and write down a note. Then an hour later, you get up at the night and write down another note to remind you to read the other notes. But, you know, this becomes a concern to the new preacher, because the new mind needs the power of memory to function and develop. Take comfort. Every thought we have is impressed in our brain. It will have its character effect on us. You know, they have taken electrical impulses into certain portions of a person's brain, and all of a sudden the person remembers something that happened to them when they were 4 years old. It's all there. And the bottom line is, I'm thrilled with this experience. The dear sister used to, her son was consecrated, age of 20, became a mentor, was put into a mental institution. She would visit him faithfully every week. For years he didn't talk to her. One day she comes in and he says, "Mom, see that man in that bed over there? Oh, the kingdom's going to help him so much." We can never write off what the new creature is learning, no matter how much a person is out of it. I remember dear Sister Schur in our class. I had the privilege of having the memorial with her, taking the memorial emblems to her and having a little service with her the last 4 years of her life each year. And I'd be there the week before, and she was completely out of it. And I'd come there for the memorial service. She would have almost a complete recall of memory. And we had a blessed service together. I remember her final days in the hospital. I was there 3 days before she died. She didn't even recognize me. Then they called me up the last day. She was very restless. And I was able to get there that early that evening. We reviewed together the joys of passing beyond the veil. We had a prayer together. She closed her eye. And a few minutes later, she died. And the nurse came in and said, "She was just waiting for you all day. She was so restless. But now she was able to die in faith." Okay, what can seniors do? Exercise stimulates the flow of blood to your brain. We need that. Try to walk 20 minutes a day. Make it three quarters of an hour if you can, 3 days a week. And, you know, Romans 8:28, "For we know all things work together for good to them that love God, who are called according to His purpose." How do we know? For we know. We know from past experience. But our memory isn't there yet. We can't recall past experience. What are you going to do? Take notes. Make a diary of all the blessings of the Lord in your life. The times when the Lord was especially with you. Note that. And go over this diary continually. Refresh your mind of the Lord's deliverances in your life, so you can really say, "For I know that all things work together for my good." And then write down things that you pray to the Lord about. And go over that list of things that you pray to the Lord about, so that you can now intelligently look for his answer to those prayers. And make notes on when you study. And review those notes. And when you're working or driving, have tapes on of discourses or the volumes, readings. Keep your mind filled with the truth, with spiritual things. And fight the desire of the flesh to become inactive in the Lord's service. Because you need this activity. Because a Christian needs a balanced Christian life. And to the degree we are active in the Lord's service, to that degree our studies and our devotional life will be more meaningful. And if you have aches and pains in the Lord's service, rejoice in bearing in your body the dying of the Lord Jesus. I'll tell you a tradition and we'll close with this. Take it for what it's worth. The Apostle John became so old and infirm that they would carry him on a stretcher or a bed into the meeting hall. And you'd struggle to get up on one elbow and you'd say, "Love one another as Christ has loved you." And he'd lay down and be silent the rest of the meeting. That's all he could say in his infirmity. But those were powerful words. And as you notice, the older brethren don't fellowship as much. They stand around. They sit around. They don't have that interplay of conversation. But cherish the few words that they do say. We are not alone in the mountain. We are with our brethren. Each one of them is necessary to be a part of that sympathetic high priest that will bless the world of mankind. The Lord bless you all.
Thank you, Brother Ken.
Brother Ken has lifted us with his heart up to the mountain of God. He's given us some very practical advice. I would add that as you write in those diaries, that you pass them along to future generations.
Thank you, Brother Ken, for that journey.